he said that this is part of my PhD thesis. This work is kind of like the previous, the last one, the most recent, not the most recent one, but the one that I was the first author, the most recent one that I was the first author. And so it was submitted like last month. So it's about the quantum trajectory. So most of my PhD thesis is about quantum trajectories and the most likely path. So for this one, something is interesting about it is like it has a nice picture, which I will show you later on. Okay, so I will try to make the talk more like informal, and you guys can have, if you guys have any questions, just hand it over to me. And then, so this is a quantum trajectory for remote entangled quantum state. So the basic idea is that you have like some kind of, you can create entanglement. There are many different ways to create entanglement. And you probably have heard about, like, for example, an experiment of like loophole-free Bell experiment that they do like an heralding entangled state by entangle the spin, two spin with the field or like photon, and then by measuring the photon and heralding on some kind of outcome, then you can herald, and you can refer that the spin state are entangled. So that's kind of like instantaneous. You know it right away, yes, the state is entangled, so that's an instantaneous process. But what about if we're trying to do something different, like using the, some kind of weak measurement, like having the system interact with the field weakly enough that you can see the process of entanglement as a continuous process in time. So this is what we are going for, trying to see how the entanglement process is happening by using that kind of weak interaction. So let's say the basic idea that we are working with is the parity measurement. So we can go through a little bit of what is the parity measurement and then what kind of things are we working on. So let's say the basic idea that we are using is, as you know, we have two qubits and then qubit has two state, 1, 0. And then, of course, the basis of the qubit state can be 1, 1. So like 1, 1 for this one, and then 1, 0, 0, 1, or 0, 0. So there are like two bases. And then now if we do some kind of measurement on it, so it depends on what kind of measurement and what kind of measurement operator. There's two kinds of measurement that we are talking about. One is the half parity measurement. Oh, let's talk about the parity measurement. And then half parity. So what is a parity measurement? The measurement operator is like sigma c, 1 and then sigma c 2. So the outcome for these two, which the z basis is just like 1 and 0 and 1 and 0. So for this state, it will give you 1 times 1, which is 1. This one will give you 1 and -1, will be -1. And then for this state will be -1, for this state will be 1. So for the parity measurement, you get these two outcomes, and there's two outcomes for the same. So that means if you do some this measurement and you get -1, that means the state can be any of these two. So if you get a measurement outcome -1, that means the state can be like, it's in an entangled state between 1, 0, and 0, 1. So it's the same thing if you get an outcome 1, the state will be entangled between 1, 1, and 0, 0. But for this one, for the particular measurement setup, so there's a measurement, there's an experiment on also the parity measurement as well. But what we are doing it here is the half parity. So what is half parity? The measurement operator is, looks like this. And then an outcome will be different from the parity case, which is this one will be 1, this one would be 0, this one would be 0, this one would be minus 1. So now they have three kinds of outcome. And if you get an outcome 1, you know that, okay, the state is in 1, 1, and then minus 1 would be 0, 0. But if you get something like 0, that means the state is entangled between 1 and minus 1. So that is some kind of the measurement outcome that infer about the entangled state. So let's see. So then we have this kind of basic idea. And then let's go to the experiment, how the experiment looks like, and then how does it work in an experiment. So this is an experiment from the group in UC Berkeley, which they have a qubit inside the two cavities. So this is the two qubits that we had entangled. And then how did they do? The measurement is basically they send the field through one cavity, and then the field go through another cavity and coming out, and then measure the phase after. So in order to explain a little bit more in detail, so like, let's say that we have the field state. So this I plotted in the quadrature x1 and x2. So this is like the coherent state input into these two cavities. So after it passed the first cavity, which has a qubit, so the qubit has a state 1 or 0, and what happened is the coherent state gets shipped either up or down, depending on the state of the qubit or the first qubit. And then after that, these fields go through another qubit or another cavity. Then what happens is if the state is in here, they get shifted up with the same amount, up or down, depending on the state of a qubit. And then the one down here gets shifted up and down. So at the end, you kind of imagine it's like two blobs expanding, and each blob expanded another two. So at the end, we will have two, or like four. So it will look like 1 and 2, and another one here, and another one there. So I can just plot it out if we like measure the voltage coming out. That would be if the state is in 1, 0, and 0, 1, you will get a distribution that is overlap. So this one can be 1, 0, and 0, 1. And then for the 0, 0 state will be here. I'm not sure if you can see. I think it should be fine. And another one here would be 1, 1. So this is the distribution of the measurement outcome that is possible. So this is like similar to like two qubit state that we have heard from like Aronoff, that either if the pointer state, it's the Gaussian state, and it can get shift depending on the qubit state and so on. But this one has four states, so it gets shift depending on the state of the two qubits. So from this idea of the probability density, which is like come right out from the experiment, the next step is how to get the information of the system by doing the weak measurement. So this is like many measurement, doing many, many times, and you get a histogram. But if you just do a single measurement and then do it continuously in time, how can you infer about the qubit state inside these two cavities? So that is another process of computing the state of the qubit or two qubits. So I would just infer to this equation here, which is basically the quantum Bayesian approach. I'm not sure if you probably have seen it before, but it's similar to how we update the information of like how we update information or the knowledge about the system by doing just a single measurement. I probably don't try to derive that equation, but basically what you see here is you can compute a row ij, which is the density matrix of the 2-qubit. So I can just write down the density, which is like 4 by 4. Will be like 1. Right here, I'm using the 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, and so on. So like have 16 of the elements. And then 1, 1, for this one, it means, so for this case, 1 means 0. Uh-oh. Let me check the, yes. So 1, it means 0, 0. And 2 means 0, 1. And then 3 means 1, 0. And 4 means 1, 1. So like these elements will be the element for 0, 0 and 1, 0. So this is like from 2 qubits, or from 1 qubit, we have 4 elements. 2 qubit, we have 16. And this is the elements of the density matrix of the 2-qubit state. And then how can we compute the state? So that equation, it says that if you do just single measurement, you get an outcome, Vt. And you know that the initial state is in rho ij, or rho zero is the initial state. And then by computing this, you will get the state of the 2-qubit at time t. So
that's what this P of V is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so first we go through what is the Vt first. Look, so Vt is the measurement outcome. Because in this case, we don't have like qubit rotation or Hamiltonian. So Vt is the signal that you integrate from time zero to time t that you want to know the state of the qubit. Oops, sorry. And then these probability here is the probability of V, which is the measurement outcome, given the I, which is the state, this one, 1, 2, 3, 4. So this is the probability of Vt given I. So I can be this in this 4 states. So because we have an idea of what is this probability of the readout, I just do it many, many times, get a histogram. You can get it, this information of the probability. And then we can compute this rho, which is the quantum state at any time from the measurement outcome. So as an example of quantum trajectories, so example like this. So this is a time evolution of the quantum state. So see that the blue one is the x1. So the notation kind of like switches over to the easiest one as time goes, because it's kind of, I don't want to keep like 0, 1 and 1, 0 and so on. So it's kind of messy in the paper. So I just keep it simplified. So x1, x2, x3, x4 would be this thing. So this one would be 2, 1, or 2, 2, and then 3, 3, and then 4, 4, and then 2, 1, 2, 3, sorry, and then 3, 3, 2. Okay, so before I go into x1, x2, x3, x4, there's something that I need to tell. So you see that these factors, which is the defacing factor. So that defacing factor depends on many different things, depends on the inefficiency of the measurement, and also because we have many different probability function. These gamma, which is a defacing, extra defacing rate, depends on the difference between the peak of the distribution. So it basically means that if you're trying to distinguish the state, you will, by measuring it, you will finally decrease the coherence of the between the two states. So it's like saying that the coherence come because of the measurement. So if you try to distinguish something, you will introduce the coherence of that two states.
That's only when your measurement's inefficient. You have this gamma inverse or eta inverse term.
Right.
So if you have a perfectly efficient measurement, uh-huh, collecting all information, then this additional decoherence goes away.
That's right. So
it's only if you just lose information that this decoherence
happens. Right, okay. Yeah, you're right. So that is the extra decoherence. So actually, I missed one thing, that inside this P, the multiplication of P, so you said that this is like PV in given I and PV given J, because if I and J are not equal, then you have another extra term that makes a decoherence. Actually, I can just write it out. Let's see. So the P is the Gaussian state. Huh.
It's okay, we can just...
Okay, so we can go... So I probably have to derive it from the form of the probability, which is like a Gaussian function. And then somehow we can extract another exponential factor from there.
You mean get this gamma term?
So gamma term is just an extra decoherence.
Yeah, it's phenomenological, so that's put in by hand.
Yeah, that's put in by hand. But then from... the case when I and J is not equal, because these two functions are like out Gaussian, and then by multiplying two Gaussian with a different peak, there's another factors that is in terms of like minus e to the minus the difference between B, like difference between the peak times T. So that factor would be a really strong, like the coherence, like damping terms. Yeah. So yeah, that gamma will be an extra one from there. So in that case, so I was gonna say that if I and J is not the same, which means you try to do the measurement that can distinguish between any two states, you basically decohere the density matrix between the two. So like, let's say if you have, because we know that we can distinguish one from these two and from this one. So you kind of guess that these off-diagonal term would be devasing pretty fast because of that extra term that I didn't write it down up there. And then also, so these factor would be disappear, that factor will be disappear as well, because one fourth, so the peak of one, which I can just draw it right here. So I will call this dv1, and this will be dv2. And dv3, this one would be dv4. So because 1 and 4 are definitely distinguishable, the off-diagonal term will decay really fast. And then 1 and 3 is also the same. And then 1 and 2 also the same. And then 3 and 4 also the same. So the off-diagonal terms will all go away except the one between 2 and 3. Which 2 and 3 gets dephased a little bit because of that gamma, because of inefficiency. But if it is a perfect measurement, then rho 2, 3 would be completely fine without the dephasing. So yeah, so I think in the paper, I didn't write it down clearly what is the terms that damp the off-diagonal part. But what I'm trying to say is because of distinguishability between 1 and 4 and 1 and 3 and 3 and 4 and so on, it makes all the off-diagonal terms decay really fast. It's actually like maybe what we're doing it here is like around 1.6 microsecond. It decays even before around like 0.1 microsecond. So by doing that, by knowing that, it makes the problem much easier because then we don't have to care about these elements at all, and we only keep 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, which they are just the conjugate variables of each other. And that is what I show there, which is like x1, x2, x3, x4. So it's just like 5 elements. So this one will be x1, x2, and this one will be x3, this one is x4, and this one will be x5. It's good.
X4 is the 1-1 population, and that decays by 0.1 or 0.2.
Say so again?
Your x4 is the 1-1 population, it's the red line?
So x4 is the 1-1 population.
So why does the 1-1 population decay that quickly?
You mean like that pictures decay that quickly? So that is not really a decay. It is just, it's like doing the Z measurement. You do it continuously in time. It either has to go to 1 or go to -1. So that is just a collapsing the state.
Just one realization of the measurement of the measure.
It just happens to collapse this quickly.
Yeah, so it just collapses. Collapse is a better word than decay in this case, yeah.
So you actually don't show any of these off-diagonals that you're talking
exactly.
about.
Yeah.
So they decay probably much faster than you.
So they decay like maybe even before 0.1 microsecond. So we didn't show it. And that makes like the mathematics much easier. So in experiment, they also checked the off-diagonal term as well. And then they found that it actually decays much faster. So we just ignore it to make it easy.
Is this decay actually due to defacing, like you're saying, these gamma terms? Or is it from the measurement collapse itself that just collapsed faster?
So you mean these terms?
Yeah, is it actually from one of these inefficiency defacing terms, or is it from the collapse?
Oh, this one. This one comes from the inefficiency.
Right. But you're saying that these off-diagonals go away, the vanishing.
That is from the distinguishability.
So from the collapse.
From the collapse.
Not from the defacing.
Oh, now it's interesting. It's two words.
It's important that they're very defacing is one of those things.
That's right.
Collapse
okay. So that comes from the collapse, yeah. Uh-huh. But that's an effect of distinguishability because of, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So that means you're moving closer to certainty, which means that these off-diagonal terms must vanish. Mm-hmm. Is it proportional to the square root of the population? Mm-hmm. So if one population goes to zero, and the off-diagonal goes to zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I shouldn't use the word defacing in that case. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
Be careful with this.
With the wording.
Mm-hmm.
Averaging over many things, yeah. Okay, so thank you. That's good. Now we have these equations, which is the Bayesian update, and this is the one single trajectory. So like the solid line is the theory, which basically comes from this equation. And then you can see that there's a point which plot in terms of like square and then stars and square and then diamond and stuff. So that data comes from the tomography. So if you ask me how did they do the tomography, it's like a really huge deal for the 2-qubit state. For like 1-qubit, you can do like X, Y, and Z measurements. And then you can do it many, many times, like tons of data, and you get the tomography of quantum trajectories. But for two qubits, they have like 16 elements. So I think, I'm not sure what's the technical detail, but they have to do 30, so like 15, because 16, 16 is like the number of elements, and then the independent element is 15, and they have to do double for some reason. This is a part that I'm not really sure about, but it's kind of a pain to get the data from the tomography. And so you can, as you can see, it's pretty nice that the tomography data and the quantum Bayesian trajectories is kind of agree.
So are they doing a similar strategy where this corresponds to a particular readout record?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they have to look at some ensemble that happens
to, match that particular state.
An ensemble that matches the same final state.
At that particular time, yes.
So it's the final state or it's the whole readout?
So it's just the... So like, let's say if you have like one single readout. So let's say this is like readout.
Uh-huh.
And then using the Bayesian approach, calculate, let's say I'm calculating the X1, which is the row 1, 1. And I'm plotting the X1. This is X1 in time. So like, then let's say you probably want to, let's say if you want to find the tomographic data of this, you get the data for X1, and then now do tons of more experiment, like tons of more of the VT, and then get a particular X1, something. And then just get the one that has, that has the same X1,
uh-huh.
And then do the tomography on this state, on this qubit, and then do the same thing as the other qubit, see if X1 match the same thing, and then do the tomography of the one that has the same X1, and then see if you really get X1 from there.
So it's point by point.
It's point by point.
So I go up to some T, they say this is what X1 should be according to the Bayesian.
Mm-hmm. Then do tomography.
The whole ensemble and pick all the trajectories that
has X1.
X1
mm-hmm.
at that particular T.
Mm-hmm.
And then do tomography over all that subset.
And then find an average and see what
sure
is an X1.
Tomography matches their prediction.
Right.
And so what they're doing is a spot check.
Yeah, that's
if
true.
The ensemble didn't give that, they'd get some other average that doesn't match the predicted X1. And you'd say something failed.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So
it's like a spot check, yes, right.
So in each of the cases in an ensemble, the readout record will be completely different as long as the Bayesian update predicts the same X1 at that point?
Uh-huh, yeah, uh-huh. Right. So it doesn't matter what it is in the beginning. We just, it's kind of the spot check. Like
that's what I'm highlighting. It's a really tricky thing.
To do the tomography.
Whether it's accurate or not, you have to really think about it.
Yeah.
It's a valid test.
Right. It's like, I think that's probably one of the possible checks. Because the thing is, with a continuous measurement, you cannot check the one that you're measuring. Because once you check the tomography on the one that you're measuring, you basically destroy the state.
Yeah. And
that,
you'll get another one that's identical with probability zero.
Right. Okay. So that is the data of the tomography and the Bayesian approach. So this is the distribution, basically integrating these four distributions, and then you will get something that looks like this. So in the beginning, four of them kind of close by, and then it just add up to one single peak. And then as time goes on, you kind of see it start to collapse to like three states here. So let's see what else that we need to. So once we have an idea of quantum trajectories of two qubits, what is next thing is we check the concurrence, because now we're interested in like how the state is entangled. So let's say for these particular trajectories, how to compute a concurrence. So we use the formula, which is actually, is that right in there? I can just show. Here we go. So this is the formula of the congruence for a particular shape of the state. So this is for the state that is in X shape density matrix. So what I mean by X shape is the all the matrix elements that is not in the this X shape is zero. So if you we can kind of do approximation because congruence is kind of typical to find because you have like to find an eigenvalue and stuff. But for the X shape density matrix, which we know that is approximately is an X shape density matrix, we can find the congruence from this formula, which is like the maximum of either zero or this quantity, like X5, which is the off diagonal terms, minus the square root of X1 and X4. And so because of these, we can compute the congruence of the trajectory. So this is the one that correspond to these four lines here. And now we have an idea of what is the congruence of just single trajectories. The question is, what about like if we look at all possible trajectories and then how, what kind of distribution of the congruence look like? And it's quite simple and beautiful in my point of view that for this case, we can just like use the Bayesian approach. We can compute the X1, X4, and X5 kind of exactly as a function of V. And then we just plug it in there, the Bayesian approach, and then you get something that looks like this. It's actually not that hard to follow because you know that X, so let's say X1, which is the row 1, 1, it is just equal to row 1, 1, 0, square root of P. So now the notation is kind of simplified to P1 and P1. So P1 is just like probability of V given 1. And then P2 is probably of V given 2 and so on. And then divided by the norm with the factor on the side, which is 0 in this case. So you kind of see that the equation up there, I basically compute the second term, which X5 minus the square root. So the X5 is just this one divided by the norm with the factors, the defeasing factor. And then the X1 and X4 is just this. And then I go through like a little bit of derivations and proof that these quantities on the right side here is always be larger than zero. This is the trick. So it is larger than zero in some case, which we are working on anyway, which is the, what's the constraint of it is if the initial state is in the product's X state. So it's like the off day, you know, everything is 1/4. So this is the initial state that we are working with. So this one would be qubit A times qubit B. Yeah, so this is the product's X state that we are using as an initial state. And then you can compute that the X1, X2, X3, X4, and X5 would just be equal to each other to 1/4. And then you can see that, plug it in there, you will see that this quantity will never get below zero. So that's make it easier because once it never goes to zero, that means we can simplify the congruence because it never goes to zero. We can just use that quantity to be exactly equal to the congruence. And we go on and then find the congruence in as like an analytic function. And then the interesting part is we find a relationship. So the thing is, this relationship tells me about the relationship between the measurement readout and the congruence. So it's like a direct relationship between the readout and the congruence. So now we all know that if we know the relationship between like one-to-one between two quantities, we can just like translate the probability density. Because we know the density, probability density of V, now we can find a probability density for the congruence. So that is just like a direct translation. And this is a theory that we found. This is a distribution of the congruence. So you kind of see that the distribution goes, so the rate is the almost one. And so the distribution goes to like peak around the bound. So this is the nice way to look at it is that you know that as a function of time, the congruence has some kind of boundary, like maximum bound on how entangled the state can be. And as times go on, it goes decay because of there's like a decay rate gamma there. And then these function, we can also get it analytically as well. So as I want to show you, this is a function, which is like exponential of minus gamma t. So gamma is the phasing rate of the off-diagonal term, or x5. And then dv over s, tells you something about how strong the measurement is. So that kind of shape, or the congruence shape, so this is like we have the distribution goes like this. And then you can find that by doing, like looking at this equation, there is some like two competitive process. One is measurement and one is defacing. So by these two rates competing, depends on that two rate, it will like the decay differently and the maximum congruence can be anything depends on these two factors. So this is the theory which we found from the quantum Bayesian approach, and this is the experimental data, which is basically pretty nice. And I found it, I was like, wow, is that easy? Okay, so, and then, I don't know, it's probably tricky too. So this is the part that is interesting too. It's not just the bound of the congruence, but it's also the, like bifurcation of the distribution. So like in the beginning, you kind of see that the trajectory goes towards the high congruence. And then for some times, it starts to go down like half maybe. No, it should be 50%, yes. 50% going down and then 50% going up, which kind of correspond to what you would expect from the basic idea here, which is 50% of the time you will get entangled state, and then another 50% you will get separable state. And it doesn't matter if it is 0 or 1, 1, it will get a 0 congruence anyway.
What are the vertical stripes?
Oh, that was just because of the, like when, because this one is a theory, I need to integrate the value of probability, and it's just the way it works. Like I have to, I think it's just the reason that it's, I try to understand it. I'm not sure what it is, but I think it depends on like how I define the chunk or the bin of the integration.
It looks like it matches up to the step sizes.
Mm-hmm.
Why would it form a gradient over step sizes?
Yeah, that I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, no, I have no idea. So I haven't looked at it into detail yet. But it's interesting that like both of them are similar.
Right. Why does that appear in experiments?
Yeah. Yeah, because in experiments also have like bin size as well, and then I basically follow the same thing. Like if the bin size of experiment is this much, I'm doing the same bin in the theory. So I match every details of the experiment. Okay, so the next thing, which is gonna be like the most beautiful pictures, which is the most likely path. So I like this idea. So now, like we have an idea of like the distribution of the congruence, and of course, the distribution of congruence tells you the path, like the two paths. One is the high congruence, and one is the low congruence. But we don't have an idea of like trajectories. So we can just like find a histogram and then pick out the peak and then draw the line of the congruence. But then we don't have an idea of what is the trajectories that has the maximum or like most likely that can happen. So I was curious about these two. So in the distribution of the congruence, it's kind of like hide the idea of what is the 0, 0 and 1, 1, 1 and 0, 0. But if I like compute the, so we use a stochastic path integral that we and Andrew, me and Andrew and Justin, we develop it together. And then we use the stochastic path integral to be able to extract the most likely path. And then as we had it before, we found the most likely path between the two quantum states. This one is kind of a little bit a step further. We can find the most likely path of the trajectories without the final state. So basically find all possible most likely path that comes out of an initial state. So let's say if I like start in the initial state, like x product of x plus state, I ask how many of the most likely path that you can have, and this is what I can get from the formula, which is the stochastic formalisms. So as you can see, we have found something that very similar to the experiment. So this solid line is the most likely path. So like you can expect the three most likely path has to come out. So that we found three of them, which is like the purple one, the green one, and the red one there. And for the experimental data, we have to find most likely path independent from the theory. So this theory really cool and experimental. So like from the theory, it's kind of simple because we can compute, we have like a formula to compute a probability, like the probability density of the path, which I'm gonna show you somewhere here. So this is the dry probability that we are like based on. So we're looking at a path that maximize these probability density of the trajectories. So what is the probability of density of the trajectories? It's just a product of probability of having the measurement outcome at every time step. So it's just a product of all of them. Because at each time you do the measurement, there is a probability density of that particular readout that attached to it. So by multiplying them together, we will get the probability density of the whole path. So that's what we are maximizing. And we can plot, there's a lot of trick behind it. But anyway, so at the end we get like the tree path, and then the data, which is the experimental data, which is kind of a little bit different. So in order to find the most likely path from the experimental trajectories. So I have to look for, let's say if we have like trajectories, many of them, the one that go up and the one that go down. So I have to find the distance between the two trajectories. So this distance is like an average distance. So how can I say that these trajectories are far away from this one? So I have to find a distance between the two of them at all time and then average it. So if we are, if they are like close by to each other, so the distance will be small. And if I like far away from each other like this, the distance will be large. And then I have to cluster the trajectories. Once I can cluster the trajectories, then I look for the path, which is like an average path that go through all of these trajectories together. So that is like kind of independent way to find the most likely path from trajectories data and then compare with the theory. And this is like, as you can see, that you can see the trajectory set goes from an initial state to infinite state. And so we're glad that we found something that very agree to the experimental result. And then the last but not least, so hopefully I'm not taking too long, which is almost an hour, 45 minutes. So the last thing is one can maybe interested in what is the most likely time to an entangled state. So what it is that I was asking the question, so any single trajectories, let's say if I'm plotting the congruence, just a single one, let's see if I get something like this. So this is the point that the state goes to the highest entangled state, right? And then I want to ask, what about the time? What is the time for this one? So let's say this one is like 2.3 microseconds, so on. And so if I do many of them doing the ensemble of the trajectories and then find the distribution of this time, so basically I'm calling the distribution of time to maximum congruence. And what I found is that's the one. So that's the experimental data. So it's kind of like a nice features of like two peak of distribution. You guys have an idea of how it comes from?
What are the different colors in the graph? There's different graphs.
Oh, sorry. So the different graph is just like a different measurement strength. So it's like three sets of data. But each set of data have some kind of two peaks feature.
You're asking why are there two
peaks? Mm-hmm. It's actually the answer just come right out from the congruence distribution. Because we know that the trajectory has to either go to entangled state or separable state. So the one that goes to entangled state, maybe like there are many of them, will have like a highest congruence around here, let's say, because it goes to the entangled state. So the highest congruence will be far away in the future. Oh, not in the future, in the later time. But then there's another one that goes to the separable state. So it maybe gets some kind of high congruence in the early time, but then go back to zero at the end. So this is like a two features that you would expect in this distribution. And then also, you can also get it from the most likely path equation as well, because the most likely path can predict that, okay, this is the path of the most likely that can happen. And then it could also predict another two, which is the separable one. So I can find a peak of this function, which is what I show here, right there, which is the peak of the one up above, and then the peak of the one below. And I found that it's roughly the same. Of course, it's not exactly the same because they have like a lot of errors in experiment, but for the simulated data, it's perfectly matched.
So the histograms are experimental?
Yes.
And the vertical dashed lines are theoretical?
Yes. Uh-huh. So yes, it's kind of drifting, which something that I would expect from here. Yeah. So like you can see that the peak of data is not the same as the peak of the theory, which is the same shifting that I found in the distribution. Yeah. So as a conclusion, this is a work in collaboration with experiment. We try to like get the data out and then trying to explain what is happening in the two-qubit experiment. And we find congruence distribution. We found the most likely path to explain this half parity measurement. We can explain the most likely path and the maximum time or most likely time. And that's it. Thank you very much for your attention.
Big question.
Yeah.
Back in your Bayesian equations, why don't you have to consider the phase back action?
The phase back action.
Right. You're considering what's called the informational back action. Mm-hmm. You just use Bayes' rule.
Uh-huh.
And you add some debasing term.
Uh-huh.
But you don't have any factor that affects the phase of the state. Because in principle, you can have a measurement that rotates your state.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't collapse it, it just is a unitary rotation. Why don't you have to consider that in this case?
I guess was that related to the Hamiltonian?
No, it has to do with which quadrature is being measured. Because when it goes through the amplifier, you have to choose which quadrature you amplify.
Yeah,
Depending on that choice, you may or may not get phase back action.
Yeah.
But since you're having a bounce-bounce scheme, it's not obvious to me a priori whether you need this phase back action or not.
Yeah.
So is there some intuition why you don't need to consider it?
I don't have the nice answer why we are not considering it. But we should. But the thing is, it doesn't change the population, I believe.
No, just change the relative phase.
I think it's just right. Because you want to do a Z plus Z measurement, and so you choose the quadrature to amplify what you want to amplify, right? If you amplify it along the Q quadrature, then you get phase back action, but you don't want that in this measurement scheme.
So you're saying that the three lobes that you're talking about must line up along a single line well enough?
Yeah.
That you don't have to consider it.
But
so I can imagine a case where two are on one line and the other was sort of off to the side. In which case, if you pick an amplification axis, maybe there's additional phase back action in that.
So I think that's part of the engineering of the coupling, right? You've got to engineer it right, otherwise it doesn't work.
That's
why it's a hard experiment.
Yeah, but I would like to discuss with you more about, I would like to see how it is as well.
I kind of expected in this experiment you'd need to put in a few more of those little tweaks to get it to match nicely.
Uh-huh.
But it looks pretty good just from a very simple model.
Yep. Right. Thank you.
Okay. More questions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I don't understand this. Why is the quadrature well fit? That's the congruence curve. A congruence curve is the set of model and the experiment. So what parameter is that did you use from the experimental data?
What parameters are used from experimental data? There's a lot of them. One of them is like the distance between the peaks.
Yeah.
Which tells you the measurement strength.
Yeah.
And then another is the extra dephasing, which is the gamma.
That is the point. The extra dephasing term. Another measurement is that it's needed to it's required to show just extra dependent time. That is because single spin, single transform with the qubit is and put it in that sort of way. So after the we waiting, then if the we quadrature set up, then if the we measure it's some random qubit, it's a we measure it's the extra time of the dependent time. But in that case, in that single setup of mm-hmm. the two transform qubit, mm-hmm. one single readout cases, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that this term is how to measure it, the coming from experimentation.
Yes, so I think that the single qubit dephasing time is much, much longer than these time scales. It's on the order of like 30 microseconds or something.
So you mean T1 and T2?
About the two qubit case.
Yeah, for the two qubit. So the reason that the purple curve goes down is because of the X5 dephasing. And that's because of the relative dephasing of the entanglement, right?
And then the majority of the dephasing comes from the inefficiency. That is like a strongest one. But like T1 and T2, we didn't take, we take into account as well. So like the T1 and T2 is around like 16, T1 is 16, and then one is 16 and one is 18 mm-hmm. for the two qubits. Yeah. Yeah, we also add that one into the gamma as well. But then how do you get a T1, T2?
Yeah.
They probably have to do it like a separate measurement.
Yeah.
So they have to, you have to kind of trust it that, okay, I'm doing the separate measurement just for T1 measurement.
Yeah. Right.
And then use that number for a single trajectory.
So it's a calibration.
Yeah, so it's like calibration.
Yes, kind of thing. You can just look at how X5 decays, right? And that gives you your gamma parameter that she's using.
That also too.
Yeah. So you have to calibrate all the parameters. But once you get those parameters, is there any fitting in these curves?
Nope. There's no fitting.
So it's just a straight.
So just like straight getting the parameter from the experiment, putting it in there. Yeah. But there is a little bit of a tricky point of.
Yeah.
So if you see that, let's see. Let's try to zoom in. So. You kind of see that in the beginning, I didn't plot the data of the theory data.
Mm-hmm.
It's because in the experiment, we have to say that in the theory, we assume that like these, the measurement strength is kind of fixed or like constant value. Mm-hmm. But in experiment, of course, it's not going to be like turning on and then constant. For sure. So it has a little bit of like transient behavior in the beginning. And we have to like cut down those data, and we have to start, instead of like starting from the real initial state, we have to start with the kind of effective initial state and then compute things from there.
Does that mean that's the transient time scale for the Rayner Academy?
Yeah, around this time, around, I think it was like 0.15.
So then kappa is around 0.02.
Oh, I don't remember the kappa. Kappa.
Yeah, but we've checked it, but the gap is the gap of uranium time.
That's important.
Hmm.
And what was eta? It was 0.5-ish. Or is it lower?
What is that?
What is your inefficiency eta for this experiment?
Eta is like 0.22.
0.22? Wow.
It's like 20%.
Because of all these couplers and...
You have to go through the circulator, and you also got this big piece of cable you're going through between the two cavities that have losses in the cables as well.
So you go through circulator once, twice, three times?
And that's, I think that's right.
plus
coax, right?
Plus coax.
Yeah.
So it's amazing you can get 50% concurrence with 22% efficiency.
I know, 50% congruence.
Yeah, I think this is a much improved version from the earlier attempt at this experiment.
Yeah, I seem to remember 30% concurrence, but I saw.
Yeah, it's much better. It's almost 50%, right? So this is an universe where one is perfect entanglement between the two qubits.
Yeah,
I don't have a capo dot data here, but I can look it up later. Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Yutaka.
Sorry, that's another question. As a conceptual thing, is that now is a well fit to that to concurrence distribution, is the experimental theory, is that from the viewpoint of the quantum trajectory. But this is this idea is that can be applied to another experiment.
Which idea?
To the quantum trajectory idea.
Yeah. So we did. Yeah. So far we did it for like one qubit. And this one is another version, it's like two qubits.
Yeah.
So we're waiting for another set of experiments so we can try it on.
So we've done like the fluorescence.
Oh, fluorescence,
right?
As well. Yeah.
Fluorescence.
The the group of
Benjamin
that they did the fluorescent qubit or supernatant qubit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the quantum trajectory's point of view as well. You can apply. Because what we need is just stochastic mass equation.
Right.
And that's basically what we need. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the two qubits are separated in two separate cavities, right?
Yeah.
Why don't you
show the figure again? It's nice to stare at it and see what they actually did.
This one?
So I missed the motivation between separating them like that, because the idea is that we want to kind of, in a sense, maximize or at least enable their interaction, right?
Uh-huh.
But then you separate them. Why is that beneficial?
Just because we can show that you can entangle the qubit, they are far away from each other.
Okay.
But people can do like entangle the qubit inside the same cavity. But
That's easy.
I don't know.
Yeah,
okay,
I guess the motivation is that a lot of interest entanglement is showing that you want to do things that are spatially separate, like Bell's inequality and things like that, or quantum communication. And so if you have things that are entangled, they're sitting right next to each other, the fact that they're correlated is not so surprising, right? But if you can put them in separate cavities separated by 1.3 meters of coax cable, right, and still be able to entangle them by a measurement, that's really remarkable.
Right, yeah.
Okay, maybe one last question. Go back to your distribution of concurrence.
This one? No.
So maybe you can zoom in a little bit on the figure. So for me, the most surprising thing about this whole project is the fact that as you go up in concurrence at any time, there is this clip. And we go to the part A, right? So if I go up from the right to the left, increasing concurrence, there is this cliff with the dashed line. Why is there that sort of cliff where you fall off and go from high probability concurrence to suddenly zero? That's the most surprising thing.
I mean, it's like a bow because of, let me think. Oh, actually, I've forgotten.
So maybe if you go to the probability distribution of concurrence, so go up in the page or two. I think we have a formula.
Okay. Are you like trying to taste me for the defense camp?
Testing. This is before the PhD.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, here, so this is the distribution of the concurrence as a function of the voltage. So this one has like come right from the Bayesian approach, which basically tells you what kind of concurrence depends on the measurement readout. So that's a relationship that I got from like deriving the relationship between the measurement readout and the concurrence. So this is the function. And then as you can see that, so the concurrence has like some kind of maximum point here, which you can go further. So that's like the shortcut point. So it doesn't matter what kind of measurement readout that you get in between minus infinity to infinity, the congruence that you will get will just be highest at that point, 0.5 something. Yeah, so that will show you the bound. So this one is like the plot for one time. So if I plot for like different times, so I will just put this peak here and we'll put it somewhere there. And then for different times, I will just get the peak for different point in time.
Okay, so why don't we thank Aria again? We'll stop
thank
there.
You.